Let me now turn to the United Nations and the UN Charter. Following the Japanese attacks on Pearl Harbor, efforts were made to set in motion for the creation of a new organization that might provide a more secure basis for peace and prosperity. The organization that emerged at the San Francisco Conference in 1945 was the United Nations, but the work program leading to this outcome had actually begun several years before and was the result of long and delicate negotiations. On January 1st of 1942, the United States, Great Britain, the Soviet Union, and China, plus 22 nations then involved in the war effort against the Axis powers, set up an alliance in which members pledged to fight until victory and to work for the establishment of an effective system of international security. The name adopted for this alliance was United Nations, suggested by President Roosevelt himself. By 1945, it included 51 nation states as members. It is noteworthy that up to October of 1943, much of the focus centered on the future establishment of some type of international entity founded on federalist principles, not unlike the model adopted by the United States during its Constitutional Convention in 1787. This would have implied the creation of a legislative body with substantial powers to enact laws that would be binding on member states. There were discussions on rights to guarantee basic freedoms and protections for citizens, such as freedom of speech and worship and freedom from want and fear, which President Roosevelt said would, I quote, secure to every nation a healthy peacetime life for its inhabitants, and also meant a worldwide reduction of armaments, that no nation will be in a position to commit an act of physical aggression against any neighbor, end quote. Indeed, the final version of the UN Charter contains what is perhaps the first explicit commitment on the part of the international community to promote economic and social development. Look at Article 55, for instance. These visions of world order, however, which were characteristic of those early discussions in 1942 and 1943, were confronted with a strong dose of reality in October of 1943 at a conference in Moscow to discuss the architecture then being embedded in the draft UN Charter. The Soviet authorities, more concerned with the war effort, said they would not object to some form of collective security mechanism, provided it was based on great power unanimity through the veto. As long as the UN was founded on the principle of sovereign equality of states and was thus rendered into a largely harmless organization, the Soviets would not object. The Moscow conference forced a shift in the focus of the discussion away from what might be desirable to what might be politically feasible. President Roosevelt wanted to avoid the fate of President Wilson, whose failure to ensure Senate ratification doomed the League. An effort was made to address some of the League's weaknesses. The UN Charter would give the veto power to the four great powers only, not to every member, as had been the case with the League. The Charter would introduce human rights protections in a way that the League had not. The final version of the Charter contained a number of protections that were substantial in scope and character. These undertakings would result in the adoption in 1966, for instance, of the International Covenants on Civil and Political Rights and on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, both of which significantly strengthened the legal underpinnings of the Charter in this area. Key issues present in the deliberations around the design of the United Nations concern the voting mechanisms and the distribution of power within the organization. Grenville Clark had argued for a system of weighted voting, with voting power linked to some objective criteria, to accommodate the huge dispersion in the size and economic heft of the membership. But the General Assembly was established on the principle of one country, one vote. Weighted voting, however, was adopted at the IMF and the World Bank, the two organizations that were created at the United Nations Monetary and Financial Conference held in July of 1944 in Bretton Woods, New Hampshire. One concern with the establishment of a Security Council in which the five major powers, France was included as a permanent member of the Council in 1945, had veto power, was the perception of the creation of an imperialistic organization in which the permanent members of the Council would de facto be running the world. To start with, the veto itself was seen by many as undermining the democratic legitimacy of the organization, as a practice that could not be defended on the basis of any principle of just governance. Non-permanent members of the Security Council accepted to be bound by the limitations of a two-thirds majority, whereas the permanent members accepted no such constraints. The veto would prevent the UN from dealing with problems and/or conflicts between the major powers, or between a major power and a smaller country. Since many important security problems in the future were likely to involve directly or indirectly one of the major powers, the UN would be largely useless to do what it was set out to do, namely, quote, to maintain international peace and security. These concerns were amply justified by the experience in the decades that followed the adoption of the UN Charter. In particular, tens of millions of fatalities associated to more than 200 armed conflicts, with the predictable consequences for delayed economic and social development. The Korean War in 1950 and Iraq's invasion of Kuwait in 1990 remain perhaps the sole examples of interventions supported by the collective security mechanisms put in place when the organization was created. The above notwithstanding, there were strong strains of thought within the United States establishment, arguing for a broader vision of world order that would go beyond the principle of the sovereign equality of states. Representative William Fulbright, for instance, had given a speech in New York in September of 1943 in which he hinted that sovereignty may be largely illusory. He argued for, quote, the delegation of limited power to an agency designed to prevent war, to establish law and order, in which we participate fully and equally with others. How can this be called a sacrifice, a giving up of anything, he asked. Grenville Clark argued that, quote, to be effective in the maintenance of peace, the general international organization must have some definite and substantial powers to make decisions binding upon the member countries in matters of war and peace. Clark thought that if member nations or member countries could not agree upon well-defined powers of an effective nature that they are willing to yield, it seems clear, he said, that no world authority really adequate to maintain peace will arise in our time. Grenville Clark proposed majority voting within this world legislature to guard against the fatal defect of the veto, which the League had granted to its members. To ensure fairness, Clark put forward a detailed proposal for a system of weighted voting, which, for instance, would allocate to the three largest countries, China, India, and the United States, a total of 40 votes or 40 representatives. And then it would allocate to the next five largest countries, Indonesia, Brazil, Pakistan, Nigeria, and Bangladesh, a total of 20 votes, and so on, with the 40 smallest countries each having one representative for a General Assembly that would contain or have a total of 758 members. Clark said that the combination of a powerless assembly and a Security Council hampered by the veto would be a weak reed to support the peace of the world. He then proposed to give the Assembly adequate but narrowly defined powers to matters directly and plainly concerned with the forestalling of suppression or suppression of aggression. Clark would come back to these ideas and principles in his masterful World Peace Through World Law in 1958, which he co-authored with Louis Son, and focus instead on reforming the UN Charter adopted in San Francisco. The big powers were not ready to give the UN binding enforcement powers over its member states, in which nationals would become citizens of a world state, in which the legislator would presumably have the authority to coerce individuals through the power of international law, as national governments were already doing, so within the boundaries of the nation state, a vision that would most likely necessitate the creation of a world police and some form of world military force. Cord Mayer, in 1945, who was an important member of the U.S. delegation to the San Francisco Conference, claims that the delegates had fairly narrow margins of freedom, not only because of the need to ensure U.S. Senate ratification, but also because the broad outlines of the United Nations had in fact been agreed by Churchill, Roosevelt, and Stalin during their meeting in Yalta in February of that year. Cord Mayer's account in the Atlantic Monthly in 1945 argued that, given the large number of sovereign players, the growing degree of international interdependence, and the increased destructive power of available weapons, the system that was created in San Francisco was not only unstable, but would be characterized by chaos and anarchy. Mayer, for instance, on the veto, pointed out, and I quote, "A major power can violate every principle and purpose set forth in the Charter and yet remain a member of the organization by the lawful use of the veto power expressively granted to it." He said that amendments to the Charter require ratification by the 5 veto-wielding members, a feature that gave them the power to permanently prevent any changes or reforms whatsoever. And then he also noted that if one of the Big 5 was not a party to a dispute, it could prevent even the investigation of the case by the Security Council.